Chapter 13. Many Ways to Die. Full Fathom 5. Oblivion Lies. White horses, crest waves rolling beneath the boat's spotlights. Engine chokes off. Destination reached. Court orders are checked a final time, and a nameless official emerges from below, carrying something. A heavy, curved vessel glistens dully under electric illumination, while the surrounding sea waits like a black moor under a cloud-shrouded moon. Seconds tick to the appointed hour. A fat splash, and the urn, for that is what it is, drops swiftly out of sight. No pearls will there be in this skull, for all was obliterated by furnace and mill. Crew wait restlessly for a quarter of an hour, clock-watching for the moment of extinction. Fashioned from salt, the death jar has dissolved. Ashy bone grist pours outwards, disperses, disintegrates, disappears. Annihilation achieved. Engines roar, eager to return to the living land, and soon no trace remains. But a dirty oil glint on the swell. Then that too is gone. All creatures are unified by death. But the manner in which they respond is far from identical. In the darkest hour between the 25th and 26th of October 2017, the remains of the reviled Moore's murderer, Ian Brady, were secretly disposed of somewhere off the Liverpool coast. A child killer, his 1966 trial was the first serial murder case after Britain abolished the death penalty. Brady inspired such public revulsion that when he finally died, funeral directors refused to deal with his remains. Finally, a judge secretly ordered a local cremation with no observance, music, or flowers, and that the ashes be disposed of at sea inside a dissolvable salt urn that would ensure that no possible marker of Brady's physical existence could be preserved. Even 50 years later, the state did its best to ensure his obliteration. Most interesting, press reports afterwards saw no need to explain why any of these extraordinary steps were taken. Official statements mentioned wishing to avoid distress to relatives, but something more was going on. The authorities actually released a statement that his coffin had been excluded from public areas and burned in a backup furnace, and that everything had been scrupulously cleansed. This was about moral pollution. Death and its handling have always mattered. Along with art and symbolism, some of the fiercest debates about Neanderthals have concerned what they did with their deceased. Despite advances in the past 3 decades, and even a newly discovered skeleton, understanding what mortality meant to them is still controversial. Some researchers maintain that to prove intentional mortuary or death-related practices, particular features must be present in every case. Others argue that a wider context is needed. Balancing these views, using modern taphonomic approaches is crucial, but so is acknowledging our own preconceptions. The simple presence of hominin bones is obviously not reliable evidence Neanderthals placed them there. But equally, the lack of a casket-shaped hole doesn't mean they didn't lay the dead to rest. Look across the globe and through human history, and it's obvious that mortuary practice has always ranged far beyond burials. Nonetheless, unpicking what archaeologists dig up is complicated because there are many ways for bodies, or bits of them, to end up in sites. Fragments of Neanderthals jumbled in with natural open-air accumulations of animal bones exist, like the arm at Torville-la-Rivière. It's likely washed up on what were sandy banks of the Seine, below chalk cliffs, through flooding around 180 to 235,000 years ago. Though what circumstances led to this isn't clear. Random parts at butchery sites are interesting, given that these locales were probably only relatively short occupations. Bits of at least one Neanderthal adult and a teenager are among thousands of reindeer bones at Salzgitter Lebenstedt, perhaps hunting casualties. In some cases, Neanderthals were the prey, or at least a carnivore's meal. On the finger bones of a child found at Ciemna, Poland, distinctive damage from the digestive juices of a large raptor are visible. Furred scavengers also took their share, shown by gnawed leg and foot bones in some hyena dens. But in places where tenancy alternated through time between Neanderthals and predators, how body parts ended up being scavenged is hard to unpick. Even for mostly complete bodies, never mind fragments, it's extremely difficult to prove that they were intentionally left at a particular place. Numerous reasons could lead to individual Neanderthals taking their last breaths in a cave. Succumbing to sickness, injuries received elsewhere, even starvation or violence. The problem comes with inflexible tick lists of how the remains of the dead should have been treated, which may overlook otherwise meaningful actions taken by the living. Burials aren't a gold standard, they're simply the most obvious. Moreover, they're also a spectrum, going from a specially dug pit to a natural hollow or niche, to simply covering with sediments. The myriad other ways bodies can be dealt with must also be looked for, even if they're not so easy to identify. Being exposed, cut up, burned, curated, displayed, recycled, or even eaten. First, however, it's worth understanding where these urges come from in the first place, with the origins of grief. Death is emotionally overwhelming for our closest living relatives. Intense bonds are the bedrock of chimpanzee and bonobo societies, and their severing is traumatic. Exactly what happens varies, but a passing is never ignored, as has been claimed for Neanderthals. Each death totally occupies individuals, and often the entire group, for many hours, with extreme emotional expression and interaction with the body being the norm. The atmosphere is volatile and explosive, flickering from aggression to submission, reassurance to dominance. Stress is released through mating or vocalizing, and most intriguingly, sometimes the sounds are those associated with fear and threat, especially similar to stranger danger calls. After a frenzied chorus in the immediate aftermath, the collective noise pulses from calm back to frantic crescendos. Yet at other times, quiet reigns. Particular individuals undertake vigils of attendance, sitting and staring silently at the body, even overnight. Sometimes the watcher's hands reach out, sometimes not, but in general the urge to touch corpses is unmistakable. Whether by poking, patting, dragging, carrying, cradling, or grooming. Interactions with bodies sometimes seem aimed at eliciting a response, whether looking in the eyes, nudging, or even trying to play. Yet circumstances matter too. Sudden deaths inspire particularly intense emotional reactions, probably as a result of being unable to rapidly process change. And social ties also affect what happens. Close relations and friends of the dead often show the most extreme responses and stay close to bodies. Chimpanzees and bonobos patently have a hyper-awareness that death signifies a change of state. And at some point, things shift. Wounds that would normally be licked are investigated but not tended to. Bodies metamorphose to materials, becoming things to be used for social displays. Once this happens, high-status individuals begin trying to control access to corpses, even if they had shown little interest while the deceased was alive. Infant deaths evoke extended responses. Babies who perish by natural causes may be carried by their mothers for weeks. More than 100 days in one case. Furthermore, mothers persist with interactions as if life lingered. Fur is groomed, faces touched, flies swatted away. But as time goes by, these instincts decay, growing less gentle and protective. Bring us the bodies. The key lesson is that mortality is experienced by those left behind, and Neanderthals undoubtedly had emotional bonds as deep as apes. Death for them must equally have heralded a tempest of overwhelming feelings and bodily interactions. The deceased did not suddenly become meaningless trash, but gained new social potency, perhaps even beyond that while alive. Corpses were like dark neutron stars, irresistibly drawing towards them passion and attention of many sorts. The archaeological challenge is seeing how this was expressed. From among the many thousands of bones and teeth from hundreds of individual Neanderthals. In some ways, bodies are like sites within sites, decaying in predictable ways as flesh, fat, and bones come apart at different rates. Kibara II is a largely complete Neanderthal's upper body from Israel. Look closely and you can see how small finger and wrist bones fell into the empty stomach cavity as it decomposed. Thanatology, forensic taphonomy, is vital in assessing how natural any particular Neanderthal skeleton is. But demonstrating burial must go further. Detailed criteria have been proposed. Pits should be artificial and filled by one sediment deposit, very different to the surrounding level. Skeletons should lie complete at the very base of the pit, preferably in an extended position, and any associated objects should be unusual. Fulfilling these exacting characteristics certainly gives confidence for deliberate burial. Yet they're so stringent that even some historical human cases might be rejected. In fact, while not taking an unduly credulous position, any site with even a partly complete Neanderthal skeleton is a klaxon for something singular going on. That's because, in general, it's vanishingly rare to find entire animal bodies within cave assemblages. Now and then, within carnivore dens, a still connected limb comes up. But whole skeletons are extraordinarily uncommon and virtually unknown for big creatures. The only exceptions are bears that died while hibernating, or animals lost deep in cave systems or down pitfalls. In a typical Neanderthal cave or rock shelter, however, in order to survive normal exposure and scavenger ravaging, bodies need to somehow be protected or made unappealing. The Abrek Romani wildcat is a case in point. Its unusual intactness probably happened only because Neanderthals butchered it just before leaving, shortly after which the next flowstone phase began. Similarly, special natural circumstances must be invoked for whole hominin corpses to be preserved. Theories range from rapid influxes of sediment to sliding into holes to becoming frozen, and therefore undetectable to carnivores. Yet in most cases, there's no actual evidence these things occurred, and moreover, we'd still need to ask why it apparently only happened to Neanderthals. Even weirder are situations where bodies appear embedded within archaeological layers. How could they have stayed intact over centuries while deposits of highly fragmented animal bones and lithics built up around them? Either group members were aware of and avoided them, or they were intentionally covered up. Diving deep into the evidence for claimed Neanderthal burials shows just how complicated things are. Many were excavated decades ago and are increasingly being held up to critical reanalysis. Perhaps the most famous cold case, controversial for more than a century, began in spring 1908. This was, in Louis Capitain's words, the year of the Mousterians. In March, the emerging remains of Le Moustier I was from the outset viewed as a burial. Then, a few days before his final disinterment in August, another virtually entire skeleton was found about 50 kilometres or 160 miles east along the Dordogne Valley. We've already met the old man who lay inside one of eight caves near La Chapelle aux Sons. The most complete skeleton yet found, its excavators claimed it was a grave. The bones were rapidly exhumed and sent to Boulle's lab in Paris. Then all the dirt was shovelled back into the cave. There it stayed for 100 years until a new project began to re-examine just how the old man came to be there. Even if the contemporary drawings were made out of scale and after the event, they support the evidence from the bones that this was a remarkably intact body. The skeleton came from the base of a pit, shown in one illustration resting on small stones. It was no loose bony jumble, and missing parts are almost all mirrored on the other side, so the whole skeleton was apparently originally there. Only two other groups of connected animal parts were found from the cave, some reindeer bones in a possible midden towards one wall, and lower leg parts of an aurochs or bison, supposedly somewhere above the old man's skull. Compared to the entire faunal assemblage, even including hibernating cave bears, the old man was less smashed up, damaged, and weathered. What's more, it wasn't just in different condition to animals, but also to other Neanderthals. Missed by the original excavators, and a local resident who continued scratching around and sending his finds to Boulle, recent research identified remains from at least two other Neanderthals, an adult and a young child. The old man's body seems, on taphonomic grounds, to have had an unusual history. But to sceptics, it's explained as an elderly Neanderthal who crawled into a natural concavity, rested his head against the side, and died. His frozen or wind-mummified corpse avoided scavengers, or alternatively, they couldn't access the body because the cave was intensely occupied by other living Neanderthals. But neither explanation adds up. The climate wasn't full-on arid and glacial. While if other Neanderthals were living alongside the decayed body, it's hard to imagine it wouldn't have become disturbed without being rapidly covered by something. Sadly, no photos of the skeleton in situ survive. But others show the head outside the cave, still partly encased in sediment. These reveal that the skull had shifted to the right of the neck, disconnecting the lower jaw and sending the chin up to the level of the nose, probably during decomposition. But importantly, the neck vertebrae were unaffected, implying that the remains were already partly supported by sediment before they rotted. Otherwise, the head would have tumbled off. This leaves the mysterious pit. The original excavators didn't note any soil differences, but they were digging fast into a candle or gas-illuminated night, sometimes breaking parts of the skeleton. Notably, the pit had supposedly been marked by a surface depression, suggesting that the sediment inside was structurally different and didn't build up slowly along with the surrounding layer. When meticulously re-excavated, 21st century researchers confirmed the pit had existed, was deeply sunken, and curiously, one edge was cut by a fissure containing vertical fragments of reindeer bone. Warping and cracking in the cave floor pointed to freeze-thaw cycles, which can force materials downwards through cryoturbation. Massive sediment disturbance involving frost heaving and sediment liquefying. If this feature formed after an earlier archaeological layer was already in place, as indicated by the fissure's contents, it's less likely that the pit was a natural erosion feature. This geological evidence doesn't definitively prove Neanderthals were gravediggers. However, in other places they clearly had the brains to make and fill pits, while the other main possibility, a bare hibernation hollow, doesn't fit either. Obsessing over its origin is something of a distraction in any case, since using natural hollows doesn't disqualify a skeleton from being an intentional deposit, as proven by the early Homo sapiens cave of Cusac, southwest France. In all, there's no natural explanation that can account for every feature of the old man at La Chapelle-aux-Saints. In 1908, it was a revelation, and thanks to modern reanalysis today, remains one of the best supported cases for Neanderthal burial. Recent studies might support some alleged burials as intentionally deposited bodies, but with others, interpretations have only grown murkier. The site of Regordou, southwest France, found by chance in 1954 during demolition of agricultural buildings, ended up as perhaps the most grandiose of claimed Neanderthal burials. After excavating independently for several years, one night the landowner found skeletal remains and called in the professionals. Despite lacking a clear original context for the bones, accounts of a curled-up skeleton inside a stone structure with offerings of bare bones nonetheless became repeated in the scientific literature. Such a story was crying out for critical reanalysis, and researchers did just that, finding almost 70 new pieces of hominin bone among the fauna. This confirmed that the body, a young adult, was one of the most complete skeletons found. But other things at Regordou didn't stand up to modern scrutiny. The bears had died while hibernating, and there's no evidence the Neanderthal was curled up or in some kind of rocky tomb. On the other hand, Regordou definitely has some strangeness. Aside from disturbance to the body by bears, and later by burrowing rabbits, anatomical connections between small hand bones indicate that the corpse had originally been whole. Yet most of the skull was missing, including the upper teeth, even though natural processes such as erosion that might have worn or dissolved it away aren't obvious. There are no cut marks either, which would definitely be expected if Neanderthals had removed part of the head from a fresh cadaver, although bears had gnawed one probably already dry bone. This all implies that the skull came off after the corpse had fully rotted, but by what means and where it ended up are unknown. With considerable understatement, the researchers concluded that Regordou is problematic. Many unanswered questions remain. What were Neanderthals even doing deep in a cave system? There are butchery traces on some of the bear bones, so hunting hibernating animals is a possibility. The low number of lithics does resemble a kill site rather than a living locale, unlike the context of the old man at La Chapelle-aux-Saints. But if so, this was a rarely visited place. Less than 1% of bare bones have cut marks. One answer might come from the fact that over time, Regordou itself changed. What began as a deep bear cave became a natural pit trap after some of the ceiling collapsed. In the same layer as the Neanderthal, remains of other creatures like deer, boar, and horse were found, victims of falls. Perhaps in the heat of the chase one unlucky day, a hunter suddenly felt the ground disappear from beneath them and went tumbling into the dark, along with their quarry. Even more interesting, the research found a new hominin bone, hinting that a second individual had perhaps met a similar fate. A final twist. Lower down the same hill at Regordu is another cave, Lascaux. Around 17,000 years ago, Homo sapiens went into its darkness to paint vast horses and bulls across the ceiling. As the bodies of animals and a Neanderthal, already 80,000 years old, lay in a chamber somewhere far above them. Perhaps one of the most intriguing Neanderthal CSI cases was only found in 1993. Somewhat older than Regordu at between 170 and 130,000 years ago, an incredibly complete body lay right at the end of a narrow tunnel in La Malunga cave near Altamura, southern Italy. Cemented in place in the apse of the man and almost inaccessible behind stalagmites, researchers needed to be creative. In addition to recording the fossils with a GoPro camera and laser scanning, they extended a delicate sampling apparatus through a gap to grab a tiny piece of shoulder blade for analysis. How did this Neanderthal end up there? The scattering of bones shows that the body simply fell apart as it decayed, but the original posture isn't clear, nor whether the individual even died there. La Malunga wasn't ever lived in. There's no archaeology at all. Getting lost doesn't seem likely as the body is only 50 metres or 55 yards from the old cave entrance. If that had already been blocked off, the only way in would have been falling down chimneys open to the surface. But unlike Regordu, La Malunga cave doesn't seem to have been a natural pit trap for animals. Something unusual happened, but all we know for sure is that the corpse decomposed slowly in the dark, bones shifting and clattering to the floor, before growing an eerie new skin of knobbled flowstone. It's impressive enough that entire adult Neanderthal skeletons survived tens of millennia, but even more so for fragile babies. Children's bodies decompose faster, so without protection, their bones are particularly prone to destruction. As Chapter 3 showed, we nevertheless have remains from Neanderthal youngsters across a range of ages, including remarkably complete infant skeletons. Unexpectedly, newborns' bones can resist decay slightly better since they're more mineralised. But even compared to very rare examples of carnivore infants occasionally found at dens, the numbers of young babies from Neanderthal sites is striking. The Lemustier II newborn mentioned earlier isn't unique. One of the shortest Neanderthal lives ended around 70,000 years ago in the Caucasus Mountains. A week or two old at most, it's astonishingly well preserved. Just a whisker above the rock floor of Mesmeskaya Cave, the tiny skeleton was found lying on its right side, knees flexed, legs drawn up, with its left arm bent slightly towards the chest. It almost appears to be napping. So intact that its minuscule tooth buds were still present. Most bones were in the correct position and largely undisturbed, aside from some lower leg parts that probably became loosened when the surrounding hardened sediment eroded. Explaining how this tiny baby was deposited and remained almost undamaged means either another series of special circumstances or the involvement of other Neanderthals. Such a young baby would be highly unlikely to be forgotten or simply dumped after death. It's true that if orphaned young chimps don't get adopted by other adults, they typically become ill, depressed, and die. But even if this was an abandoned body, other questions remain. Newborns typically don't learn to roll for many weeks, so the side-lying posture is surprising. And though rodents nosed and nibbled the exposed dry leg bones, there's no damage at all from large scavengers. Moreover, despite no evidence for a pit, compared to the rest of the cave's lower layer, the sediments immediately around the skeleton were distinctive. Instead of any lithics or fauna, there were small charcoal fragments lacking elsewhere. Whether this baby died at Mismiskaya or somewhere else, the balance of evidence implies that it was intentionally placed and protected. We can almost certainly envision a mother, likely still bleeding, breasts swollen with milk, giving up the small, soft body into not much more than a scraped-out hollow, before covering it over, perhaps with the remains of a dead hearth, and finally leaving. In contrast to the Mismiskaya baby, which was excavated relatively recently, little can be said about how the Lemoustier II infant ended up in the ground. Peyronie's claim of a surprisingly large pit is hard to evaluate, since he apparently made no drawings and took no photographs. He recorded that the filling sediment looked like a mix of the three layers it cut through, which would support a dug feature. And the unweathered bones certainly point to rapid covering. No information on the body's position has survived, but it was just as complete as Mismiskaya. Once again, either very unusual natural circumstances were involved, or the Lemoustier II infant was deposited by other Neanderthals. We should expect Neanderthals coped with the emotional wreckage of losing youngsters in many different ways, some of which may only be perceptible archaeologically through subtle indicators. Across ancient human cultures, while some deceased babies were buried, others were placed in middens, walls, wells, under floors, or even inside jars. The correct approach varied according to each society's understanding of infancy. The Roc de Marsal child, whose tooth contributed to our understanding of growth rates, might represent something like this for Neanderthals, where a body was deposited, but not in a way that could be called a burial. Reanalysis of this 1961 find over the past decade was aimed at examining the largely complete skeleton's odd resting place, a hollow feature in the limestone. While the hollow is entirely natural, how the body got in there isn't obvious. It lay face down, slightly angled downwards, leading to suggestions that the corpse had slipped in somehow. But the legs both face right and are tightly flexed, while the left arm trails down into the hollow. It's hard to see how that posture fits with either being washed in or moved by flowing debris. And furthermore, the climate at the time wasn't extreme enough to mummify or freeze the body. Certainly, the Roc de Marsal child was yet another example of a fully connected corpse when it entered the hole. Aside from dangling finger bones becoming muddled by earthworms and the lower legs being damaged due to exposure, it's remarkably complete, without carnivore damage. This cannot be claimed as a burial, but neither is it satisfactorily explained by natural processes. The cave contains no evidence for massive, rapid sedimentation, so the dark material around the body, identical to that in other hollows, must have built up slowly. Perhaps a lost or abandoned child crawled in and died, albeit in an odd position. On the other hand, being aged between 2.5 and 4 years old argues for a strong parental bond. If the child died and the group was present, the urge to interact somehow with its body may have been intense. This could easily have included moving and placing it in a small contained space. There's a final interesting fact. Along with typically fragmented lithics, animal bones and teeth, the sediment around the skeleton also contained three unusual objects. Hyenas, birds and complete bones are all very rare throughout the rest of the site. But inside the hollow, along with the Neanderthal body, were intact reindeer and partridge limb bones, plus an entire hyena jaw. They may not be overtly special like shells or pigment, yet their association to the skeleton only adds to the list of questions here. Places of death. If individual skeletons are difficult to decipher, the phenomenon of multi-body sites is even more so. We already saw that remains from more than one Neanderthal were at Regordeu and La Chapelle-aux-Sons. And reanalysis elsewhere shows the same thing. At Le Moustier in 1910, Hauser found an isolated skull fragment, and possibly a tooth, the locations of which are now a mystery. And even Feldhofer harboured more bodies than was once believed. In 2000, researchers relocated refitting pieces of the original Neanderthal from the surviving cliff foot rubble heaps, and also found parts from two other individuals. Scraps are one thing, but what should we make of places with more than one mostly complete skeleton? They've sometimes been called cemeteries, but that implies a persistent tradition over many generations. If Neanderthal skeletons come from separate layers with clearly dissimilar archaeology, a continuous practice is hard to countenance. But on the other hand, particular sites are undeniably over-endowed with the dead. This is visible even among the Neanderthals' immediate forebears. Parts from nearly 30 individuals came out of the natural pit at Cima de los Huesos, Atapuerca. They probably arrived in the chamber en masse from somewhere higher in the cave system. But the sheer numbers, both adults and adolescents, is extraordinary. Furthermore, the only accompanying artifact is a pink quartzite biface dubbed Excalibur by the excavators. At the dawn of the Neanderthal world, it seems that concepts of places for the dead were already emerging. Probably the richest of all is Krupina, with some 900 pieces of bone from across the skeleton. However, they're so smashed up it's tricky to calculate how many Neanderthals they represent. Just based on the teeth, it's at least 23, the largest number known for any site, but using other methods, it may be nearly 80. Krupina is exceptional, but two other places also have parts from at least 20 individuals. At La Quina, they're spread across a number of adjacent locales and layers, but Lochtus, also in France, is especially intriguing. Located in the middle of a near-vertical 100-metre or 330-foot cliff, this cave's interior is narrow and chute-like, not a comfortable home. Nonetheless, this didn't put Neanderthals off from using it for very short stays. Although in later layers, something seems to change and bones, including many children and a baby, begin accumulating in one section of the site. This went on for centuries, maybe millennia, but why is an enigma. There don't seem to be particularly exceptional preservation conditions, so was it something more? There are other places that were never extensively lived in, but still contain many bodies. Not far from Cueva de los Aviones in Spain is the Cima de las Palomas, a deep shaft that is filled with deposits between MIS6 and MIS3. Nearly destroyed by 19th century miners, it lay abandoned until a local naturalist abseiled down in 1991 and spotted hominin bones stuck to the wall. These were remnants from what had been an enormous cemented rocky pile. Over the next 25 years, archaeologists undertook painstaking excavation using a specially built scaffold and established that this wasn't a hole down which hapless Neanderthals fell, but something more complicated. Aside from very few lithics and some burned animal bone, parts from at least 10 Neanderthals had accumulated, probably over centuries and perhaps even longer. Most striking are three quite intact individuals, all coming from a period apparently falling between 45 and 55,000 years ago. Lowest was an adult, then a child, and uppermost was a very short adult woman. And importantly, the skeletons were unarguably still articulated. There are also distinctive postures. One of the woman's legs was extended, with the other crossed beneath, while her arms were bent and hands up near her face. The hands of one of the other individuals were in a similar position. Certainly, this was never a living site, but it seems a stage beyond Regordu and wasn't an easy place to accidentally fall into. The site is located on a massive marble mountain that rises up from the flat coast, with the shaft itself like a wound in its flank. And something repeatedly attracted Neanderthals here. A rather different place, but with nearly as many Neanderthal bodies, is the La Ferracie rock shelter. Unlike Cima de las Palomas, this was certainly a living site, which makes the accumulation of at least 8 individuals especially unlikely by chance. The probable male LF1 was largely complete and the first to emerge in 1909 after road building in front of caves uncovered the rock shelter. The next summer, LF2, smaller and probably female, appeared just 50 centimetres or 20 inches to the west. Following this and up to the 1920s, another 5 sets of remains came out from beneath the main rock shelter, from which up to 1,000 cubic metres or 35,000 cubic foot of sediments were removed. There are also parts of many children. The youngest of all was LF5, a 2-month premature infant, while LF4B was a newborn, LF6, roughly preschool age, and LF3, around 10 years old. 6 decades later, a different team uncovered a toddler, LF8, at the rear of the rock shelter. In recent years, excavations have been renewed at La Ferracie, aiming to understand how at least some of these Neanderthals came to be there. They relocated LF1 and LF2's precise positions, partly thanks to matching up sediment still encasing one of the latter's feet. Both skeletons were close in depth and date around 47.3 to 44.3 thousand years ago. The other individuals also appear to be at roughly the same stratigraphic level, and LF3 and LF4 were separated by even less space than LF1 and LF2. This means that La Ferracie has some of the best evidence for multiple skeletons reasonably close together in time, and when the faunal collections were checked in 2019, new teeth from at least another 2 adults were identified. Some of the flashier claims about La Ferracie over the years haven't held up, such as special objects in graves or claims for circular carvings on a massive limestone slab covering LF6. These are natural features, and similarly, what were called pits in other parts of the site are likely depressions caused by freezing processes. But could any of the skeletons have been intentionally deposited? Most were roughly oriented east-west, and LF1 was lying not quite flat on his back, with right arm raised and the left extended down straight. Both legs were bent and angled to the right, also seen in LF5 and LF3. The head faced left, lower jaw gaping open and slightly separated from the skull. This odd sprawling position was potentially explained by the new research. Sediments in the western zone of the rock shelter containing LF1 and LF2 had come from a platform above, outside the caves. both bodies may have slipped downslope extremely gradually. La Ferrassie might not be the cemetery it's been claimed to be, but something out of the ordinary must explain why so many bodies accumulated, even over many centuries. They particularly stand out compared to the handful of later Homo sapiens scraps here, and the number of youngsters is especially striking. Most important, like La Chapelle aux Sons and elsewhere, the hominin remains were in different condition to the animals, more complete, with little weathering and no gnawing. La Ferrassie hints at some sort of long-term tendency for dealing with death that involved depositing bodies here. But another site has even more impressive evidence. You may have heard of the massive Shanidar rock shelter in Iraqi Kurdistan for claims that one skeleton was accompanied by funeral bouquets. That theory is now regarded as unlikely. The pollen was probably naturally accumulated. But Shanidar is still remarkable because it produced parts from at least 11 Neanderthals, many obviously originally whole skeletons. 10 came from excavations between 1953 and 1960, while fieldwork over the past few years has uncovered another individual. Understanding Shanidar is tricky, partly because most of the fossils weren't dug up to modern standards, but also because even today the site has a reputation for dangerous rock collapses. Such accidents might explain some of the skeletons, including Shanidar 1 or S1, S2 and S3. Notably, the peculiar position of S5 could have been caused by a rock breaking the individual's spine, forcing the head back on top of the rock. Confirming this scenario is now difficult, even though more parts of the skeleton were excavated in 2015 and 2016. But if a rockfall was responsible, it must have been sudden, even though S5 was probably aged over 40. This Neanderthal didn't have the same physical challenges that might have slowed down S1. Very singular circumstances, however, are found for five of the other Shanidar Neanderthals. Even if the flower story wasn't proven, the associated body S4 had an interesting posture. Curled up, almost in a fetal position on its left side in a rocky niche, the knees drawn right up and the left hand apparently close to the face. Skeptics would point to the lack of any pit features and propose that this individual simply died in that spot. However, the local climate wasn't cold or dry enough to naturally preserve the corpse, implying it was in some way protected from erosion or disturbance, but there's no obvious natural source of rapid sedimentation. This is where things get weird. The S4 skeleton was highly fragile, and the excavators decided to remove it as a single sediment block in 1960 for later excavation at the Baghdad Museum. As they prepared, it was realised that fragmentary parts from two other adults and a young baby, S6, S8 and S9, were right below those of S4. So close that some of the remains had become mixed. One of these other adults also appeared to have been curled up. But there was more to come. When excavations resumed nearly 60 years later, the area around the block was relocated, plus more fossils that had been left sticking out of the trench wall. Meticulous work revealed them to be the entire upper body of a mature adult, lying almost directly below where the other Neanderthals had been. Moreover, its posture, although flatter on the back, is strikingly similar to S4. The crushed but complete skull lay on its left side, with the right arm across the beautifully curved ribcage, hand clenched. Beneath the chin, the left arm was tightly bent up, with the wrist flexed back on itself, almost as if they were sleeping. Given the relative position of the block and the uppermost location of S4, It's quite probable that the new upper body actually belongs to either S6 or S8. Such a tight cluster of at least four individuals is already unique in Neanderthal sites. The only place where so many skeletons are closely associated in their original positions. And it gets better still. Examining the context of the new bones, researchers found that they were surrounded by rapidly deposited dark brown sediments, probably the rotted remains of the body, but also with some intriguing plant remains. And in what's the best evidence yet of a burial pit, everything was contained within a depression with a distinct curved base. Originally, this might have been a water channel, but micromorphology suggests it was deepened by artificial scooping. Most remarkable is an artifact that may have been intentionally placed with the body. Among the new bones, there were only two lithics, one of which was found within the chest cavity. It's oriented vertically, but probably slid that way as flesh below decayed, and is just a few centimetres from the left hand, as if it might once have been held in the fingers. Taken together, although Shanidar isn't exactly a Neanderthal necropolis, there's absolutely more going on than the remains of those who perished by rock falls. Even in those circumstances, there's great likelihood that survivors might have physically interacted with bodies. Sudden deaths are especially traumatic and might have provoked attempts to move or position corpses. But the cluster of three adults and a baby really suggests that these bodies were either put into the same small space over a very short space of time, or that Neanderthals returned to the same spot repeatedly. In relation to the latter theory, it's very interesting that two unusually large rocks stacked on top of each other are located quite close to the new skull. They weren't part of a rockfall, but would have extended upwards through the sediments, remaining visible as the other bodies also accumulated. Whole Neanderthal bodies resting in the earth have always drawn our attention. But what about the bony tatters? Are they simply the lost, abandoned, or other unfortunates? Difficult to interpret, orphan skulls and other body parts are widespread in caves, but also in the open air. Looking just at Germany shows quite how rich and varied some landscapes with Neanderthals can be. River gravels produced the Steinheim skull, another from Warendorf, plus parts of an adult and a very young child at Sarstedt. A large piece of skull comes from up in the Warnen-Ochtendong extinct volcanic crater. And Germany is also well known for travertine spring and tufa sites with Neanderthal remains. Along with the hunted rhinos at Taubach, adults' and children's teeth were found there as early as 1871, and, similarly, teeth and skull fragments from at least three individuals came from Bilsingsleben. Some open-air locales had unusual preservation processes, alongside perfect imprints of oak leaves. Fragments of at least six Neanderthals were excavated from the travertine quarry at Weimar-Eringsdorf. Though most were skulls, more complete remains of a child included a jaw, parts of the chest, and an arm encased in the travertine, not far off from parts of an adult. In such places that must have attracted herbivores and carnivores alike, it seems unlikely a small corpse would have avoided becoming dispersed, unless it was perhaps submerged in a pool. Elsewhere, explanations for other body parts remain elusive. At Ein HaKashish, just north of Mount Carmel in Israel, Neanderthals were active in the landscape over long periods of time between MIS4 and MIS3. The odd hominin fragment is present in early levels, but a later layer contained much of a Neanderthal's lower body, an almost connected left thigh and shin, part of the right lower leg and a backbone. All came from within the same couple of metres and probably represent a single young male individual. The surrounding landscape, wetland fringes of a floodplain with seasonal pools, would have been attractive, and the Aina Kashish individual may have been out hunting. One potential cause of death could be an old ligament injury that probably gave him a limp, making him a target for furred hunters. Yet, there's no carnivore gnawing, and his bones still have their grease-rich ends. What's more, the lair in question is well preserved, including refitting lithic scatters, and it seems unlikely that erosion would have removed the upper half of the skeleton. But open-air locales weren't simply hunting drive-throughs. Places such as Les Bossas tell us Neanderthals did many things outside caves, including processing pigments. At Aina Kashish, in the same layer as the bones, there are ochre fragments, possible limestone anvils or grindstones, and a marine shell brought from at least 10 to 15 kilometres or 6 to 10 miles away. None of them are directly associated with the bones, but they're extremely unusual for this region. Had such a collection come from an early Homo sapiens site, one might well see claims for symbolic activities. Neanderthals must have felt deep urges to interact with bodies, but how this panned out might have depended on where the deaths happened. Out under the sky, the right way to deal with death may have been different to inside caves or rock shelters. Although specific evidence for body placement is sparse, places like Aina Kashish may reflect some kind of active Neanderthal involvement. The closest cut. We can't be sure that Neanderthal remains at open-air locales were intentionally manipulated, but recent research has found that other things than burials were happening with bodies in caves and rock shelters. More and more cases of unquestionably butchered Neanderthal bones are being identified, even including some of the original Feldhofer remains. In general, Neanderthals were covering the full range of what they did with animals: skinning, dismembering, jointing, defleshing. Sometimes also comprehensively snapping and smashing bones. Neanderthals have actually been known to do this since 1899, because the first identified case was among the hundreds of bones at Krapina. All parts of the skeleton across multiple individuals there had been processed, with skinning and defleshing, even of skulls, plus some smashing. The discovery of this early in the history of Neanderthal research and its interpretation as cannibalism laid the foundations for an aggressive reputation. In contrast, nobody noticed for decades that Le Moustier I had been butchered. Original publications, Clatch's diaries, and surviving photographs of the site show the odd position of the skeleton. The skull was face down, angled back with the lower jaw slightly detached. In contrast to the diary entry and a sketch by Clatch suggesting some of the upper body parts were in anatomically correct positions, the photos show long arm bones sticking out from the back of the neck. This wasn't an articulated body. Modern analysis revealed that, as well as being disordered, the Le Moustier teenager was butchered. His skull was skinned and defleshed, tongue removed, jaw cut off, sliced, and possibly battered, and the meat from one femur was also removed. Interestingly, however, his body hadn't been left scattered, and the skull and lower jaw were actually next to each other. Moreover, excavation photos and documents record that his face and forehead were lying directly against an unusually large flat stone, compared to other rocks in the surrounding sediment. Though separated by many tens of millennia, Krapina and Le Moustier are later Neanderthal sites. It's during this period, after about 130,000 years ago, that body processing seems to be, if not common, then no longer rare. In many contexts, there's little difference in how hominin and faunal remains were treated, with similar focus on marrow-rich body parts. A newly identified site, Cirogne, southeast of the Périgord, is a good example, with Neanderthal teeth missing their roots, most likely from jaws being smashed for marrow. Perhaps surprisingly, however, direct proof Neanderthals were actually eating the processed bodies is scarce. Tooth marks aren't common on animal bones, so those on hominin remains are especially noteworthy. At least one leg shaft from Crepina has shallow, paired grooves, looking exactly as if someone had gnawed it, like a corn cob. In general, however, tooth marks are extremely scarce. This is particularly noticeable when compared with cannibalism among Homo sapiens from various periods in time. Around 15,000 years ago, bones from at least six people, possibly just a few generations of one group, were butchered at Gough's Cave, southwest Britain. They were processed similarly to and jumbled among the hunted animals, but a whopping 65% have processing traces and nearly half also bear tooth marks. Burning of hominin remains is also very rare among Neanderthals, and it can be ambiguous. At Zafaraya, Iberia, although three burned pieces were found in association with a hearth, just as with arguments over cooking animal bones, this might have been accidental. Crepina also has burning, however, and given the abundant evidence of body processing and eating, it's a fair suggestion that some of the dead here were cooked. Let's assume at least some cannibalism was happening. The question then is, why? As cases mount up, 21st century analysis is pointing to more subtle interpretations than simply calorie chasing. At Crepina, although whole bodies were obviously present, the most nutritionally rich bones don't appear to have been selected for processing. Something similar was happening at El Cidrón. Previous chapters have covered the biology and behaviour of the 13 or more individuals here. But they were also probably cannibalised. The bones had been very intensively processed, with traces of dismembering, slicing, and hammering. Yet, despite some bodies being taken apart, it doesn't look exactly like typical animal butchery and isn't systematic or targeted to the richest parts. The bones had no carnivore damage or weathering, and some parts from the chest, arms, hands, and feet were still connected. Moreover, the representation of elements is strange. Facial bones are mostly missing, but there's a hyoid, an especially fragile bone that supports the voice box, and toes are oddly numerous. However, there is one pattern across the El Cidrón bodies. It's the youngsters who have the most cut marks, which is hard to explain if this was solely about nutrition. Let's come out from among the bodies and think about cannibalism itself. For any species living in small groups at low population densities, regularly eating each other is a highway to extinction. And it's not even good economics, since compared to animals of roughly equal size, hominin bodies are surprisingly poor in terms of nutrients. Could it be starvation? Hunter-gatherer lifestyles can be challenging, and in some recent populations, famine was known and feared, though rare. Were times so much more desperate for Neanderthals? Some cannibalism cases have been linked to glacial conditions. For example, dismembered and filleted remains of two adults, two teenagers, and two different children come from level 25 at Comgranal. Probably dating around 70 to 65,000 years ago and full of cold-associated reindeer. But things aren't that simple. As we saw in Chapter 10, Les Pradelles is most certainly a keener reindeer hunting camp, but new evidence shows it wasn't dramatically colder than Wales or Scotland today. And it's important because among the butchered animals, there are also remains of at least 9 processed Neanderthals. They include adults and children and were treated in a nearly identical way to the reindeer, with defleshing and bone ends smashed off, presumably for marrow. This assemblage has been claimed as another case of nutritional cannibalism, but this doesn't stack up. Not only was it not extremely cold, but the immense amounts of butchered reindeer surely imply that, at least seasonally, food wasn't an issue. At the opposite end of the climate spectrum, interglacial body processing sites have also been argued to result from starving Neanderthals unused to hunting forest creatures. Crepina is dated to the Eemian, but probably after the climate peak, and may even include the leap period of extreme environmental disruption after 121,000 years ago. But the bones come from 2 different layers, so it's highly probable that the butchery practiced there covered a longer period in time. Intriguingly, however, there is another cannibalism site that may be contemporary with Crepina. Level 15 at Moulagercy, a cave in southeast France, has very similar dates, and at least some of the fauna, such as porcupine, might be connected to aridity. At least half the remains from 6 Neanderthals, an older man, an adult woman, 2 teenagers and 2 children, were butchered. The Moulagercy processing is quite intensive, with skinned skulls, removed tongues, dismembered joints and limbs, defleshed legs, and systematically smashed bones. But there are arguments against climate-driven interglacial famines. Sites like Neumark Nord make it clear Neanderthals had adapted to forest hunting, taking out fallow deer with precision spear strikes, and even leaving good meat and marrow behind. Huge elephants were being targeted too, even if the Leringen carcass and spear site is scavenging rather than a kill locale, these Eemian Neanderthals clearly had access to a lot of food. Smaller prey were certainly also available, including tortoise or beaver. There also doesn't seem to be higher rates of malnutrition in any of the body processing sites than elsewhere, nor compared to some recent hunter-gatherer populations. The only clear pattern with regard to environments is the total lack of any body processing from outside Europe. Rather than being connected to particular climates, might cannibalism simply imply that Neanderthals ruthlessly chomped down on weaker individuals? Children and elders would be most at risk, but they don't outnumber butchered teenagers and adults. Plus, one man at Moulagercy is among the largest known Neanderthals, and surely would have been risky to attack. Antagonism towards strangers is another explanation. Goyer, in particular, has been proposed as an example of aggression-motivated cannibalism. The butchered parts are lower legs, skulls, and thighs, which does match economic selection for meat and marrow. Abundant cut marks on more than a third of the remains record dismembering, defleshing, and even less common gutting gashes on the pelvis and ribs. In addition, there were huge amounts of bone cracking. The only complete bone is a fingertip, and probably crushing of the long bone ends, all of which points to consumption. However, the theory that these were foreigners who were attacked and eaten relies on interpreting the isotopes as reflecting non-local individuals, rather than Neanderthals who simply had a very large territory, fitting lithic transfer data. Other places confirm that those being eaten were from the local area. Anatomical quirks on the bodies from Crepina and El Cidron suggest the dead were from closely related, probably local populations. And at Moulin-Guercy, isotopes indicate that at least one of the butchered individuals probably grew up within just a day or two's walk in the same region that many of the lithics were coming from. If groups were competing for the same land, then conflict could erupt. But the generally wide age range of processed bodies would imply either mass slaughter or ambush killings over a long period of time. Furthermore, butchered bodies don't have higher rates of violent deaths, and we'd need to assume Neanderthals tended to be aggressively territorial. As discussed earlier, the collaboration and food sharing at the heart of their societies argues against this. In fact, cannibalism and butchery may well have had primal motivations, but not necessarily rooted in ravenousness or belligerence. Chimpanzees offer fascinating parallels. Though they hunt much more than used to be believed, and social disagreements can be very violent, killing is rare. Murders nearly always involve other groups, but only if the odds are very stacked and victims are almost always adult males or infants. Killing within groups is extremely unusual, but infanticide is known. Babies tend to be targeted during times of extreme emotion, either following conflict with strangers or triggered in males by some kind of post-hunting bloodlust. Cannibalism is sometimes part of these social dynamics, meaning that the consumption of a body for chimpanzees is inherently about something beyond nutrition. Sometimes corpses are enthusiastically consumed and shared, just like hunted prey, or they may be treated aggressively. Adult bodies are even struck with branches or rocks. But in other cases, the interaction is calmer, more exploratory, and eaters only take small amounts. Pieces of killed adults are occasionally eaten, and females within the same group seem especially prone. However, babies are the most often eaten, and they're also more completely consumed. Infanticides after hunts are particularly likely to involve communal cannibalism, sometimes including their mothers. Bonobos once again provide an intriguing counterpoint. There are no recorded infanticides, yet several cases of mother-infant cannibalism exist, which also featured meat sharing. In one situation, following a baby's natural death, the group spent an entire morning eating much of the body before the mother carried away the remnants on her back. This demonstrates two things crucially important to understanding Neanderthal cannibalism and body processing. First, there is no need to invoke aggression as a default. Second, after consumption, the dismantled scraps aren't transformed into waste, but still treated as representative of or connected to the deceased. For both bonobos and chimpanzees, the bodies of the dead evoke many emotions. Even if the process often begins with trauma and confusion, typically corpses shift to a liminal status, not alive, but equally not a lump of meat. They're more intensively manipulated than hunted animals and carried for longer. In some, if not all cases, the eaters must know what and who they're consuming. Cannibalism is very probably a powerful means by which individuals and groups process the impact not only of killings carried out on emotional impulses, but other deaths too. In other words, it's about grieving. Such contexts are just as likely, if not more so, in Neanderthals. Moreover, we might consider that both chimpanzees and bonobos use tools in their interactions with the dead. Corpses are poked at with sticks, as if to wake them. But even more astonishingly, in one case, the dead individual's teeth were picked. After the death of a male named Thomas in a Zambian sanctuary in 2017. His adoptive mother, Noel, refused to leave the body. During her attendance, she began intently cleaning Thomas's teeth using a grass blade, watched closely by her teenage daughter. Teeth picking with grass or wooden splinters for chimpanzees is inherently an intimate, caring act. The very first individual was reported to do this about 5 decades ago. Named Belle, she was part of a sociable group of orphaned youngsters, was especially keen on being the picker, and quite remarkably was observed removing a loose milk tooth for her best friend. Shift these scenarios to Neanderthals and add into the mix their far greater cognitive sophistication and lives that revolved around using lithics. Suddenly, it's not difficult to envision how skills in carefully taking apart hunted carcasses might be transposed into a grieving process that involved butchery and cannibalism as acts of intimacy, not violation. By examining Neanderthal cannibalism and body processing in detail, there may be evidence that points towards this kind of interpretation. Most strikingly, the butchery itself isn't always identical to what happened with animals. It's sometimes more intense, even if the method is similar. This trend actually goes back into the Lower Paleolithic, visible at Grandolina, where bodies were also butchered at twice the rate of fauna. There was greater attention to heads, removing tongues and brains, and even fingers and toes were skinned. Similar patterns are there in some Neanderthal sites. The Crapina remains seem more intensively smashed than the fauna. And at Moulin-Guercy, half the Neanderthal remains have cut marks compared to under a quarter of deer, and even less for other species. Plus, the bone smashing is extra focused, potentially using anvils, and only hand and foot bones remained unbroken. Another difference is that only animal bones bear burning traces. Idiosyncrasies are found elsewhere. At Les Pradelles, the reindeer and hominin butchery rates are the same, about 30%. But while the animal parts were clearly selected and brought to the site based on their nutritional value, this isn't the case for the hominin remains, with few limbs and many skull pieces. Something quite different was going on with the Neanderthal bones here, and it's more than where they came from. Despite not being obviously separated from the animal bones in the site, the condition of the hominin remains is much more varied, showing more carnivore damage, including teeth that had passed through hyena stomachs. This points not only to a different accumulation process compared to the fauna, but also in what happened to them at the site, potentially including being exposed. Eternities. While each context of body processing and cannibalism is unique, it's possible to explore conceptual connections between them. Neanderthals could probably have butchered anything blindfolded, and like chimps with toothpicks, they drew on familiar skills in their desire to connect with the dead. Perhaps this, together with consuming the body, was a comfort amid the confusion and fear summoned by death. And there may be hints that, just as we do, some Neanderthals tried to keep a part of the deceased with them. As researchers have increasingly scrutinised faunal bone collections for worked objects, including retouches, examples made from Neanderthal remains have been discovered. At both Crapina and Les Pradelles, fragments of thigh bone were used, while at Goyer, 4 retouches were made on shards from the thigh and lower leg. Moreover, there, the Neanderthals appeared to have specifically chosen hominin bones, in spite of their lesser suitability than other species and skeletal elements. It seems that, as with most animal examples, the retouches at Goyer and elsewhere were used while the bone was still fresh. Neanderthals weren't simply picking up random fragments. and the choice was potentially happening during or not long after the body processing itself. Moreover, at Goye, the retouchers were particularly well used, with multi-phase damage. They were kept in the hand for some time, even if it's not clear how long. So far, all examples come from body processing sites, and there's no evidence that these, or indeed any retouchers, were carried between places. But it's a tantalising possibility, and a reminder that we don't know how the majority of isolated Neanderthal bones and teeth arrived at particular sites. If death was bound up with emotions, is it possible there was a personal element to butchering, eating, and using bodies? It's very likely that at least sometimes the deceased and the butcher had a relationship in life. Faces are well known to be the key focus for human communication and individual identity. And so it's intriguing that heads seem to have had extra attention in some contexts. At Moulagercy, unlike the deer, all the hominin skull fragments had butchery traces and were particularly fragmented. Similarly, the Le Moustier 1 skull was comprehensively taken apart, but butchery traces are only present on one other body part, his right thigh. This brings us to one of the most singular artifacts from any Neanderthal site. In 1906, La Quina was the first place where prehistorians worked out what bone retouchers were. But it's also well known for producing, across several layers and areas, remains of at least 22 Neanderthals. Among them are several pieces of a fractured skull, probably from the same young adult. One cut-marked fragment also bears distinctive battering damage from use as a retoucher. Neanderthals, with their exceptional knowledge and appreciation of anatomy across species, would absolutely have known what they were handling. Even more than the Goye retouchers, the choice to use this object was not accidental or casual. Its shape and thickness are well outside other retouchers at La Quina or elsewhere, and furthermore, it's the only known skull retoucher from any species anywhere. This object was selected despite its unsuitability, and while there are other unusual retouchers in the same layer, a reindeer jaw and horse tooth, the skull represents the only Neanderthal bone from this level. Skeptics might still be looking for something that goes beyond practicality to prove that reducing the dead into constituent parts was a practice that resonated in social and symbolic ways. Stunningly, it exists and also involves a skull. The most complete cranium from Carpina bears a series of 35 mostly parallel tiny cut marks running from slightly above the brow ridge over the forehead towards the rear of the skull. Just 5 millimetres or 0.2 inches long, they don't fit any butchery pattern, are totally unique at that site, and have no parallels in any other hominin skulls, whatever the species. Yet, they do recall something. They represent the longest series of sequential markings made by Neanderthals, even more than on the hyena bone at Les Pradelles or the raven at Zaskalnia. Their placement on a hominin bone and moreover a skull, the most symbolically resonant part of the body, is extraordinary. What it most closely mirrors is behaviour of Homo sapiens people who lived more than 100,000 years later at Gough's Cave. There, in addition to the body processing and cannibalism, bone modification was also going on. Skulls were carved, possibly to act as vessels, but most remarkably, on a smashed long bone fragment, someone etched a delicate, repeating design formed of small cuts. Is it possible to move from individual objects or skeletons and say something about what death meant to Neanderthals? the complexity of their interactions with bodies, whether depositing whole or partial skeletons, butchering them, or using them as tools, dovetails with growing skill and diversity in other aspects of behaviour, including hunting, material technologies, and aesthetics. The greater frequency after 150,000 years ago is also probably not just down to better preservation, but an amplification in social practices. Additionally, it's noticeable that places with Neanderthal remains often contain parts from multiple individuals. There may also be trends in what happened to whom. Neanderthal communities were certainly constituted by commonly understood categories, including age and gender, probably reproductive status and sociability and skill levels. These characteristics would have influenced how individuals treated each other in life, and perhaps in death too. One of the most remarkable patterns is the apparent paucity of female skeletons. This isn't due to difficulty in identifying sex in fossils. Where genetics are available, the anatomical classification has been confirmed. Age also shows some patterning, with the very young and elders more often found as individual skeletons than processed and recycled bones. Krapina, for example, is full of butchered adults, but there are no infants. On the other hand, children seem associated with the potential multiple body deposits. The Shanidar 9 baby was in the same small space as one adult male and two likely adult females, while Garrod believed that next to the Taboon woman's upper left arm, there was an infant, though no remains emerged during excavation of the sediment block in London. And speaking of the Near East, while there are plenty of skeletons, so far there are no known cases of body processing. This chapter might leave you with the impression that Neanderthal fossils which had odd things happen to them are all over the place, but it's more complex than that. Some sites have a few pieces, others many skeletons, and there's also no clear correlation in regard to body processing between or within sites. The Lemustier teenager was butchered, but the baby was not. Then there is the fact that plenty of locales with rich archaeology have no Neanderthal remains at all. Hugely conspicuous is Abric Romani, occupied for tens of millennia and excavated to high standards, yet none of the hundreds of thousands of bones are hominin. Other Iberian sites that Neanderthals seem to have used in similar ways do have hominin remains. A child's tooth and skull fragment were found in 2016 at Teixonares, and Cova Negra contains bones from at least seven individuals, two adults, one older child, and four little ones. Just as intriguing are sites where things shifted over time, and in some cases, like Loch Tus, the presence of bodies might have influenced what else Neanderthals did there. Choices between depositing or fragmenting bodies might also have been linked to the fact that Neanderthals needed to be highly mobile and may not have expected to return to a particular locale for many months. Far from denoting different mortuary traditions, some of the variability we see may reflect contextual decisions linked to the way that loss could be managed depending on movement and season. How to be dead. In essence, it's now very hard to maintain that Neanderthal bones all accumulated by random processes, or in the case of butchery, that it was just about filling hungry stomachs. Once the breadth of mortuary practices is understood, the borders between what they and early Homo sapiens did with the dead begin to look fuzzy. Neanderthals were also potentially engaging with bodies before we did. The Taboon woman, who was laid out nearly flat on her back, may date as early as 140 to 170,000 years ago. But just as with the aesthetic traditions, there remain divergences. No intact Neanderthal skeletons come from open-air sites, though they're also rare among Homo sapiens until after 30,000 years ago. From then on, spectacular burials exist. Double or multiple burials are also more common in Homo sapiens, including two 27,000-year-old newborn ochre-covered twins from Kremswachtburg, Austria. The identity of the dead may also be different. Among Homo sapiens contexts, while adult males are just as overrepresented and there are few women, notably elders aren't more common, undermining claims that they lived longer. Strikingly, there are also far fewer very young children and babies. An even clearer difference concerns body posture, which seems more formalized in Homo sapiens. There are more early examples with strongly bent limbs than in Neanderthals, but over time, a sarcophagus-like pose becomes more common, flat, with straight arms and legs. In contrast, Neanderthal bodies tend to either be partly or wholly lying on one side, sometimes with fetus-like flexed legs, but in other situations, they're bent or extended asymmetrically. Spectacular grave goods are definitely a Homo sapiens phenomenon. Just a few minutes downriver from Le Moustier, Peyronie discovered that the La Madeleine rock shelter contained a young child's burial dating around 11 to 9,000 years ago. Like the Moustier II baby, he recorded that it was found in a pit, but there the likeness ends. The child was laid flat with an aura of red pigment, and around the head, shoulders, knees, wrists, and ankles were thousands of tiny animal teeth and shell beads. They would have taken months to cut and grind to size, and wear patterns show they had rubbed against each other over a long period. They came from Atlantic and Mediterranean beaches in addition to fossil shell sites, pointing either to vast territories or extensive exchange networks. Most significantly, they are miniatures of those in adult burials, strongly suggesting that children received objects special to their stage of life. The remarkable La Madeleine burial summons up a vision of a child that once laughed and ran as its embroidered clothing shimmered and tinkled. No Neanderthal sites have anything like it. But what's the best evidence for special things placed with their bodies? Claims for grave goods are often quite subjective. Goat horns near a boy's remains at Teshik Tash, or articulated horse and panther feet at Cima de las Palomas, are unusual, but not clearly associated with the bodies. The odd stones under Le Moustier I's face certainly were, but with such an old excavation, it's impossible to say more. The atypical chert flake just a few centimetres from the curled fingers of the new Shanidar remains is tantalising. But the most convincing case is another Near Eastern Neanderthal. Amud 7, a baby no older than 10 months, was excavated from a cave near the Dead Sea in the 1990s. Exactly like the Mismiskaya infant, it lay on bedrock on its right side, and despite some crushing by sediment, even fingers and toes were in the correct position. What marks Amud 7 out is that nestled right against its hip bone was a large red deer jaw. That species is common in the cave, but complete bones are rare. There is no intervening sediment, indicating that the heavy, perhaps still fleshed jaw was placed directly on the corpse before it decayed. Yet this isn't exactly burial bling. Neanderthals seem to have had an aesthetic interest in coloured minerals, shells, and perhaps bird parts, but there's no sign of anything like that with the dead. On the other hand, not all early Homo sapiens people got richly endowed graves. The mortuary practices of the first Upper Paleolithic cultures in Europe between around 45 and 30,000 years ago were actually more akin to Neanderthal bodily interactions. They kept bits and pieces of skeletons, including pierced teeth. Truly jaw-dropping burials, like a double child grave at Sungir, Russia, don't really appear until more than 10 millennia after the first Homo sapiens. And the Golden Age burials tend to blinker us to things these people did that mirror more ancient Neanderthal-like traditions. At Sungir, ochre-covered bones were being brought from other sites and placed alongside skeletons. Even cannibalism was happening in the Upper Paleolithic. Brillenhöhler Cave, southwest Germany, is a few thousand years older than Gough's Cave and contains partial remains of four intensively butchered adults and a baby. This is assumed to be a funerary ritual, not murder. Outside the Eurasia bubble, however, there's an interesting reversal. Early Homo sapiens populations in Africa produced masses of evidence for complex behaviour, but there are hardly any skeletons. Only two sites have relatively complete bodies, one of which dates to around 70,000 years ago, with pre-existing quarrying pits containing the bones, though there are no associated artefacts. The other site is Border Cave, South Africa, which contains a possible infant burial of a similar date. However, it was excavated in 1940, so precise associations between bones, a claimed pit, and a single shell, originally strung and covered in pigment, aren't clear. If the Neanderthals had a mortuary record of this paucity, it would most certainly be held against them. Death is worth an entire chapter because it's so deeply woven into how we define and differentiate ourselves from other animals. Neanderthals neither ignored corpses nor treated them like rubbish. They were not unmoved in the face of death and the need to process, if not rationalise, emotional trauma most likely came through interaction with the corpse itself. Neanderthals as fellow beings struggling with mortality paints the rest of their existence in very different shades. How they dealt with their trauma was diverse and included depositing bodies as well as taking them apart and bringing their raw components back into life via consumption, using them as tools, or marking them in special ways. By focusing on burials as the best measure of mortuary meaning, we devalue the uniquely Neanderthal ways of doing things. Similarly, starvation or violence as primary explanations for cannibalism stem from recent Western taboos. In fact, bodily consumption as grief management is little discussed but does exist. In 2017, a tabloid story reported a British woman who regularly eats the ashes of her mother. And this isn't the only case. If it sounds outlandish, consider that curating bodily relics, from locks of hair to bony ossuaries, has long been embedded in Western society and, in the Christian Eucharist ritual, the bread and wine are literally believed to become the body of Jesus inside the mouths of the faithful. Catholics say this is not about death, but life. Maybe the same was true for Neanderthals. The most important lesson is to take Neanderthals at face value, rather than squinting through a lens tinted by our own expectations. Those tiny cut marks across the crown of the Crepina skull stitch together many elements of their existence. Bone as food, material, and canvas, as well as the lithics that made them. To our eyes, they're not aesthetically striking, that surely were significant to their maker or makers. Fragmented and marked bodies mirror the broader pattern of Neanderthals taking apart, moving around, and redepositing many materials. In so doing, they stretched and distilled actions, memory, and identity through time and space. Just as hearths were cause for movement in sites, the presence of the dead may have impacted processes of placemaking at a landscape scale. Locales associated with the dead can have unique social potency, hinted at in the way chimpanzees, bonobos, and even elephants appear to either revisit or avoid locations connected to deaths and corpses. If Neanderthals were differentiating places and entire landscapes through the things they choose to do, then involving dead bodies in this would only be an extension of existing behaviour. We can even imagine that the enormous variety of environments they lived through bled into how they responded to mortality. What did it mean to die in a world of beech forests rather than one where massive herds of reindeer churned the tundra? There's only one conclusion to draw from all this. If mortuary traditions extend beyond our own species and even back to our last common ancestor with Neanderthals, then so too does a key definition of humanity. No formalized spiritual framework was needed. Neanderthal funerals probably ranged from ardent and anarchic to methodical and precise. Just as the extinguishing of life drags out a primal keening in us, they too were motivated not only by fear, but also love. And it's these emotions that underlay the end of our entwined story: annihilation and assimilation.